being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Texas.
Yeah, it just keeps raining. It's not raining at the moment, and actually I can see a little blue sky, but it's finally starting to not be wet anymore.
Oh. Nah, it's pretty wet.
You know what? That's also very, very wet.
Anyway, how sweet it is. We've got a show tonight,
And it's been a while since we did one, and it's great to be here. And
oh, it's only been 2 weeks.
Oh, it feels like a lifetime. So many things have happened since then, none of which I'm going to go into.
That, well, and thee and me. Anyway, what made my eyes bug a little bit is something that is possibly somewhere on the net at the moment. A Dublin company, Steorn, S-T-E-O-R-N, announced a free energy device.
I remember hearing, seeing news reports about this about a year ago, and the first thing I thought was Tesla, you know, and all the other free energy ideas out there. And the thing is, I mean, haven't we been seeing marketed already in the last few months this wireless device that, the way they're, one way that of configuring it is like as a, where you would put a light up in the top of your room, and it's a series of coils, and somehow they put a current through it or whatever, and it gives off energy in nearby electrical devices of a certain variety or certain frequency response, I guess, pick up that energy. It's basically just a resonance phenomena, but with through magnetics and energy and
Tesla broadcaster.
Exactly. And so I just, you know, electromagnetic fields, transfer of energy wirelessly, but we're talking free energy, you know.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's impossible. I don't remember hearing or seeing anything about it. That's definitely one to look up. And if anybody else out there in Radioland happens to know of it, please drop us an email at precognitivedissonance.com. But supposedly they started the experiment today, the device, the Orbo.
Orbo
demands! Skeptics can view the device lifting a weight from four different camera angles online. The experiment, as I said, is supposed to start today and run through, I believe, the 23rd or the 28th of this month. Presumably, there's a video online.
At Steorn, steorn.com/Orbo/demo.
Ah, an important update on the Connecticut demo. We are experiencing some technical difficulties with the demo unit in London. Our initial assessment indicates this is probably due to the intense heat from the camera lighting. Connecticut will not be open to the public today, 5th July. We apologize for this delay and appreciate your patience. We have commenced a technical assessment, and we'll provide an update later today. So, anyway, there is a still of the device at the source of this story.
RTE.ie, or if you search for the headline, Dublin Company to Unveil Free Energy Device. Yeah, it's RTE News at RTE.ie. And, yeah.
Well, anyway, it...
The device, if I remember, it looks kind of like a...
Just a little aluminum frame sort of thing.
Yeah, like an erector set or something. I mean, not very...
Actually, it looks like a small sighting device.
Wait, it's some kind of transformer.
Da, 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 da. Okay.
It's a robot in disguise.
I'm actually kind of looking forward to the movie. It looks like a big, dumb action movie.
Well, it has to be. It's directed by the guy that did The Island.
Well, there you are. Yeah, I didn't see The Island.
Great premise, great in terms of science fiction ideas. Incredible military-industrial entertainment complex, precision action explosion niftiness going on. I mean, just the most outrageous, like, oh, come on, please don't insult my intelligence with this grandiosity of ridiculousness. But they did. Dublin Company to unveil free energy device Wednesday, 4th of July.
And, well, they're running a little bit behind, but...
Experiencing technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Another interesting science news article, vaguely UFO-related, is the Tunguska Russian... object historically devastating to the countryside circa 1908.
Yeah, one of those awfully nice, it was so remote because it could have been a disaster. Anyway, a Russian team believes that they might have found something that has eluded searchers for almost a century, and that's an actual impact crater. Every account I've read of Tunguska indicates that the fireball exploded in the air.
Yeah.
You know. But
knocking down trees for miles.
Yeah.
800 square miles of trees, according to the Space.com article.
Yeah. There is an interesting line in this story on Science Tuesday at space, www.space.com. We can only explain that and the shape of the lake as a low-velocity impact crater. So, you know, we might be looking at something where there, you know, a part of it exploded in the air and another part smacked into the earth.
Hmm. This article's circa last month of June 26th. Again, it's space.com, and the article is written by Dave Mosier. But, of course, it's a seasonal article. Note the, in late June of 1908, a fireball exploded above the remote Russian forest of Tunguska, Siberia. I had forgotten that it was associated with, you know, a summertime event that was the shot heard around the world, according to many people. And the Italian researchers... The lake in question is Lake Cecco, I guess that's how you'd pronounce that, and is 5 miles northwest of the epicenter of the destruction, which was, again, like 800 square miles of trees knocked down. The photos of that are always really stunning.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, many people have posited, you know, what could this be? Could it be something more exotic than a meteor? And so there's been, of course, a whole... micro subset of the UFO publishing industry.
Very, very small explanations. A micro black hole, an atomic powered spaceship, a comet is one of the more prosaic explanations. Trying to think of some of the others. That's the only three that I can call to mind at the moment. But, well, you know, one thing that occurred to me was, you know, a large, basically the drive unit exploding and the crew quarters impacting.
Oh, yeah, I just was listening to on NPR to them talking to the teacher they're about to send up, who was the follow-up to Krista McAuliffe. You talk about an exploding spacecraft and the crew cabin going off, being jettisoned off, and immediately thought of the space shuttle Challenger, since that's what I was just hearing about in the car earlier. That was a real sad day in a lot of ways. And they played a quote from Krista McCullough where she was, you know, expressing her delight at how she'd been selected and how she was, but some of the words she chose were kind of rather, took on a different meaning for me, you know, after the events of that day. She's talking about, you know, it's not just going to be me on there, there's going to be all the souls of the other teachers, and anyway. So yeah, here's this article talking about some of the more exotic ideas, like a UFO crash to a wandering black hole. And I saw this headline caught my eye, knowing your interest and mine own interest in large birds. Takeoff's a problem for giant bird from Yahoo News. Science writer Washington weighing in at 150 pounds or more, the all-time biggest bird couldn't just hop into the air and fly away, researchers say. A team led by Sankar Chatterjee of Texas Tech University used computer programs originally designed for aircraft to analyze the probable flight characteristics of Argentavis magnificens, a giant bird that lived in South America 6 million years ago. We've commented many a time on this show about that famous picture with the silhouette and the person standing next to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just magnificent to invoke the...
That's interesting. This article says, with a wingspan of about 23 feet, Argentavis is the largest known flying bird, the researcher said. It sounds like the upper limit of size for it has been downsized since the original finds, because I remember them... the article saying it had a span of 25 feet. A minor point, but it sounds like a little bit more is known about the animals now. And something that is interesting to me in here is the actual weight of the animal. That would be a fairly muscular creature. And if the flight muscles aren't strong enough to, you know, actually physically get it off the ground, I wonder if the leg muscles were, you know, correspondingly stronger so that it was more of a terrestrial bird or equally at home.
That would be scary enough. a bird with a 23-foot wingspan, but with its wings not folded, you know, hopping around on the ground and occasionally unfolding them and scared.
Yeah, I mean, it was about 6 feet tall standing up.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it would have had a beak a bit longer than my head.
Hawkzilla?
It could peck you up. and, you know, the thing is, there are the so-called terror birds that were flightless predatory birds, reached a height of 8 or 9 feet, I believe.
I saw, I mentioned Hawkzilla, but I saw a TV, most of a TV episode on the Hawkzilla investigation, the digging up and analysis of that. And of course they had to go all in depth on, you know, cultivated and feral hog populations, both in Britain and the United States. And
I didn't know Britain had a problem with them.
The map showed at least three or more feral populations, and then they showed, you know, the red spread on the map of them over time, given their expected survival rates. And so it looks like it's definitely going to be a problem for them, but... for those who don't know, the Hawkzilla story is rather perhaps archetypal, and it's a monster prowling a bayou kind of a story that whereby this huge pig either that was either presumed to be feral or that had escaped and become reverted to its animal instincts was roaming the marshes for like 7 years around this farm. But as the documentary was pointing out, they were using like high protein fish pellets to feed the local stock pond that they operated, where they had actually produced one of the largest, fastest growing fish that had already gotten honors or props for its Zilla-ness. And the idea was basically that that perhaps this thing had been feeding off those high protein pellets, and that had aided its becoming a
Brobdingnagian.
And anyway, they exhumed it, and the body and the head, which were buried separately. And the tusks were really amazing. They completely looped back. It was like a horseshoe.
Oh, that's not good.
And the overall size, though, was about 4 feet shorter than the advertised 12 feet.
So yeah, it was 8 feet or 7.9 feet, something like that.
Right, instead of the 12 claimed. Yeah. And estimated to be about, I think, 800 pounds as opposed to 2,000.
Yeah.
Or... yeah, I think it may have been that. No, Yeah. Significantly less, and
about the size of a rhino,
but still a damn big pig. Would not have wanted to face that thing down. And of course, shortly thereafter, there was all the news reports about the kid who downed one with his 50 caliber pistol as part of his rite of passage that his father had engineered, and then we were only to learn that it wasn't even an escaped. It wasn't a feral hog, and it wasn't even an escaped captive hog. It was someone's pet pig.
Released on a reserve.
Well, or I think actually sold to sold to this hunting farm.
Mm-hmm.
So,
not a very uplifting story to my recollection.
Especially when you looked at the father and the son.
But, both of them, Hogzilla, at any rate, is the basis for two motion pictures that are currently in production. Reportedly, very much in the sci-fi movie channel vein of stalking monster.
Dear God, save us all.
More dead teenagers.
Send more teenagers.
So, what have we got next? Free energy, giant birds, big pigs.
Big pigs. Well, there was this article I had caught my eye from Michael Prescott's blog at michaelprescott.typepad.com. And I guess I've been seeing articles linked to his blog from anomalous.com, always a great source of news and headlines of all things weird and strange and anomalous. Whether ufological, cryptozoological, or Fortean. And apparently he's been tackling a lot of mediumship, paranormal, channeling, spiritism type stuff. And but I guess I thought he was one of those new upstart parapsychology blogs that was maybe a little more scientific. And, I mean, his thinking seems sound enough. He's mostly quoting from, I guess it would be sociological investigations of such phenomena. But it reminded me of a book that I had in the archives on channeling that was, though I haven't read the whole thing, it looked pretty definitive in terms of its approach and breadth of evidence and that sort of thing. And, he's blanching.
I've never been told that before. A bit. Mediumship, channeling, the two terms are basically the same thing. But for some reason, channeling just has this cachet of disreputability. I had a chance to skim the Prescott blog article, and it's one of those, it's a remarkably simple and appealing idea. One of the, he basically says the formulation of the question is wrong. And that is that, the validity of mediumship is challenged basically on the basis of sometimes the medium is simply making up stories. And the counter to that is that, well, that assumes that some personalities are more real than others. And when you get right down to it, all personalities are simply information.
Constructs from information and experience.
So it's one of those, well...
They're roles.
Yeah, and...
They're masks.
They're roles, but there is a distinction. And that's, experience. Because, vicarious experience can allow you to make certain estimations, but it's not the same thing as direct experience. So I can see something of a quibble with the argument there, but other than that, I find it a very elegant little piece. It's one of those, what difference does it make if you have something to learn from it?
Okay, this is one of these articles that I printed out, show to Craig just right before the show. He reads it quickly, and I'm still trying to read it, and I often never finish because I don't read that quickly. And it's okay. Looking at it, and I noticed it invokes the Philip experiments, the book Conjuring Up Philip, and these are a series of experiments that have always intrigued me, and it's right in tune with the idea of trying to experiment with the idea of thought forms, tulpas, or similar phenomena. And for those that aren't familiar, Conjuring Up Philip tells the story of some researchers who basically more or less perform a seance with a fictional character.
I think I remember reading a review of the book.
And I think I know somebody's attempted to replicate these experiments, and I don't believe I've ever read any skeptical debunking, tearing apart of the original experiments. But basically, the idea was, okay, well, what if you do a seance and you try to contact a spirit that doesn't exist or one that's been made up? And, of course, this can tie into a lot of my ideas about Rupert Sheldrake and others' ideas about morphic resonance theory and the theory of formative causation and archetypes and the collective unconscious. And like, I've always wondered, like, okay, well, if with remote viewing, what if somebody remote views a mythical character or a fictional character? They can just as easily describe the characteristics of a fictional versus real thing. So what's the difference? And what does that mean for remote viewing? What does that mean for perception and experience? And so I find it fascinating to entertain the idea of these archetypes being able to be slipped on and off, perhaps, and some that are, and what this guy is implying is what's the difference between doing that and slipping on your own personality?
Yeah.
Interesting. The book that I mentioned that it reminded me of is Channeling Investigations on Receiving Information from Paranormal Sources by John Climo, forward by Charles Tart. Charles Tart being one of the preeminent alternate science consciousness researchers. This guy has done so much amazing research into parapsychology, dreams, hypnosis, and other strange unknowns. And it's huge. It's this voluminous, it's like over almost 500 pages with a full index and glossary. And the chapter areas cover all the basics from channeling as a modern, section one, the personalities, channeling as a modern phenomena, channeling as an historical phenomena. Who does it? the material, what do they say, what are they channeling, how do they do it. And there's a lot of citations of experiments where they like hooked people up to EEGs and stuff to try to see if there was any physiological difference in their brain activity during these things. So, but yeah, that's this guy's point over at michaelprescott.typepad.com with his controls, communicators, and personas article. That's an interesting read and an interesting idea. So many people when I was encountering, when I was early on in my UFO quest, you know, you end up inevitably coming across the Space Brother, you know, contactee material, and there's a lot of spiritualism type things described in a lot of channeling and that kind of thing in the early contactees and then modern contactees. So I inevitably would come across references to the Ashtar Command and these other recurring, again, archetypes in the field of contacteeism and channeling phenomena. And these, it's like you'll encounter all these same people, you know, that are allegedly channeling the same entity. And sometimes they've, you know, they've already been exposed to it, so it's easily explained in terms of them perhaps just already knowing about the name of that being or entity or persona. But then in other cases, they don't know anything about that. So, so what else? Well, of course, you know, we're near the, well, we're in the 60th anniversary zone for the Roswell 1947 alleged crash, recovery, and cover-up. That's kind of like the Rosetta Stone, Holy Grail of ufology in its modern form, which, of course, I guess there is really only one ufology, really. He's staring intently... he being my co-host, at alienviewgroup.blogspot.com, where I've got up on the screen Alfred Lindbergh's wonderful ufoetry.
It reads like a bar of Dr. Bronner's soap.
Well, it's poetry. And the story he's reading about is the story of John Ford, and this is where I love Alfred's... UFO poetry and his writings. I've enjoyed them for a long time on UFO Updates e-list, which you can find at virtuallystrange.net, and look for the link to UFO Updates. It's the best UFO list out there. It's been going since the mid-late 90s, and it's got all kinds of amazing researchers and experiencers on there, all the old stalwarts from the old ufology. But Alfred Lindbergh is this great, quote, retired military aviator and failed public school teacher.
What a person attentive to UFOs and their ancillaries, because inattention seems unintelligent, unprogressive, and unbrave.
Yeah, to finish out the quote. Anyway, Alfred's been posting to that list for a long time. He's very active in that list. The electronic community, and he's been doing these ufoetry poetry bits for a long, long time. And I remember sometimes I'd say, honestly, it was tough to get through him. I'm not generally into poetry, but I figured, you know, this guy is really...
The more I read it, let me just give the folks a sample. Loitering streets, some far worse than him, released and at large. These are monsters, my friend. John is locked up like a serial fiend, when, in truth, he's done nothing but question and dream. He's scorned for his courage of strident conviction. He's jailed for reasons concocted from fiction. He lives a perdition of slow rot to please those who make out if he's brought to his knees.
And the article, the name of this bit is, Isn't That Queer? And, of course, as he used to do, and I guess he still does, after the bit of rhyme and riddle, there's his more down-to-earth straight talk. And put it together yourself, reader, he says. The accused, John Ford, has an altogether efficacious history to the very moment of his alleged crime. The accuser, John Powell, in suspicious contrast, is associated over a period of many years with tremendous graft, political corruption, and an open-ended racketeering enterprise for which he later pleads no contest and is convicted. This is the story, and I'm not reading from the website here, but this is the story of John Ford, who was just an earnest, honest, if goofy, UFO guy up in the Northeast, who, in his quest for the truth and in his efforts to use the system as we've been told as Americans it's supposed to be used in terms of petitioning your government and trying to get facts and data that, you know, we paid for to be categorized and cataloged, he ended up running afoul of this local politician who was incredibly corrupt. And apparently this particular part of the country is one of the, if not the, most corrupt in the country. And after this guy is set up for allegedly hatching a plan to kill this local politician using plutonium in his toothpaste, they lock him up without a trial, and he's been sitting there for years. And in the meantime, the individual who brought him up on these charges, who he allegedly was trying to kill, has been found guilty of racketeering and other charges. So, anyway, Alfred Lindbergh's site is alienviewgroup.blogspot.com, and it's the Alien View. He's a very prolific guy. He writes for UFO Magazine now, where he's also going into in-depth depths. he's going into
kind of a pretty site too. I like the
that's the template. That's I believe the art is his. And there's a lot more where that came from. So what else? Yeah, here we are. It's July 5th, and the Roswell UFO Festival is in full swing. Our pals Nick Redfern and my good friend Greg Bishop are out there, as are, I'm sure, a number of other UFO freak friends of mine. From around the country and around the world, I've seen estimates of supposedly 50,000 people there.
Wow.
For the 60th anniversary of the crash of something, either a plain old weather balloon or a special weather balloon, or reverse-engineered Nazi flying wings with retarded Japanese. You take your pick. Or food.
And that's not all art.
Tell them what else they've won.
They've won a crashed scout ship from Alderaan, complete with dead crew, one still living, cowering in fear.
But who loves strawberry ice cream.
Well, you know.
So I mentioned my good friend Nick. Nick's a good friend, but my really good friend Greg Bishop has been selected as one of the ufologists who was queried about his top 10 picks for UFO cases by 40 and Times. 40 and Times, the world of strange phenomena. That's at 40andtimes.com. They've done a special 60 years of UFOs. The top 10 cases are UFO panel list. Their top UFO cases from the last 6 decades. And among the people mentioned are Stan Friedman, everybody knows him, Bill Chalker, Gary Heseltine, Greg Bishop, Nick Pope, Thomas E. Bullard, Jenny Randles, David Clark, and Andy Roberts, and Hillary Evans. Now, this is obviously very British heavy. It's also accepting the presence of, say, Friedman and Pope, and perhaps Clark and Roberts. I'd say it's mostly psychosocial heavy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it's absolutely male heavy, and that's all I'm going to say. Jenny Randles, Thomas Bullard, and Greg being some of my favorite people, let alone UFO researchers. Thomas, if only because we used to sport the same sideburns for a long time. they each gave their top 10 list of best Well, I guess
let's see what we got here.
Greg's top 10 list. Number one. Drum roll, please. I love it. Flatwoods Monster, West Virginia, USA, 1952.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, as he says, you all know this one. This is the one with the floating spectral dressed, spade-headed, glowing-eyed, vapor-breathing monster that was sighted on a hill nearby after a presumed meteor or light streaked down behind a hillside nearby. This is the case that really launched the career of Barker. I can't remember his first name. It's not Bob.
Gray.
Gray Barker. Thank you. Gray Barker wrote a number of UFO books and was good friends and co-conspirators with ufological prankster Jim Mosley, who does the Saucer Smear newsletter. Also on the list, number two, Kelly Hopkinsville, Kentucky, USA, 1955. This is the famous case where
Hopkinsville goblins.
Yeah, the gray, silvery, glowing, goblin-y looking beings that, again, were seen after falling lights were seen nearby, but they terrorized, allegedly, this rural family, which didn't take kindly to it and started trying to fill them full of buckshot.
To which the creature seemed almost impervious.
Would act as if they'd been hit, but like fly backwards in almost a gentle manner, and then float down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They were also on the rooftops grabbing women's hair from above, and when the cops investigated, they didn't find any evidence that they'd been drinking, and they did find evidence of the shotgun blast through screens and doors as described, as had happened.
Something definitely happened.
But we don't know what.
But, yeah, it's also one of my favorite cases. I'm hopefully planning on doing a couple of sculpts of goblins, maybe making a set and releasing those as kits along with the Mothman, which I do have the mold half done for as soon as I can get back into the house.
We'll see if that ever happens. Number three.
Gee, thanks.
I'm sorry.
That was just mean.
Antonio Villaboas case, Brazil, 1957. This is actually, in a lot of ways, one of the earliest known alien abduction cases, only it's actually almost more of a contactee case. It definitely was some contact going on.
Ahua!
Ooga!
This is one of those cases that I don't like.
You don't like?
No, I hate it.
I love this case.
I never got picked up by an alien, horny alien chick in a spaceship
horny
who growled.
Alien, horny alien redhead who, growled like a dog.
I thought she was bald.
The pictures, the representations and the reports that I have, I'm more familiar with, always say redhead.
Oh, okay.
True redhead.
Oh,
and she, after having sex with Antonio, pointed to her stomach and then pointed to the stars as if to imply that they were siring a intergalactic love child.
Alien baby.
So this guy, working in the fields in Brazil. Hey, what's that? Landing crafts. Beings get out. And that's the thing. I don't recall what the other beings were like, but he did describe other beings, I think, that were dwarf-like.
I thought they were closer to the classic grays, or at least that's the artistic interpretations I remember.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm remembering a pictorial. I know now where I got the bald from. It was a pictorial in Hustler or Penthouse many years ago.
That's the best place to see it. Number four, unknown, along Pan American Highway, Chile, 1950s.
This is great. Let me read this one. I can't recall the details of this one, only that it was recounted in one of the APRO books by Carl Lorenzen. A motorist stopped to examine a strange object along the road and was surprised to see it being shaped, as I recall, like a 3-foot banana, with skin that looked tan or gray, like tan or gray terry cloth. This case is either a hoax or one of a kind, and very funny as well as disturbing.
I'm so disturbed.
It's a 3-foot banana. Who wouldn't be? That reminds me of a case.
Stop getting behind me. Get away.
Jim Brandon mentions from, I want to say, Oregon or Washington. A couple had just heard a report of a UFO being sighted in the area on their car or truck radio. And as they were driving down this stretch of highway, they see this kind of greenish glow on the right-hand side. And as they come abreast of it, it's a four-legged creature, kind of scaly, with a head shaped like a football and a pair of antenna coming off it. And they said the legs looked rubbery. You know, like they weren't actually
animated.
Jointed legs. You know.
Like noodles.
Tentacles. And the thing was just apparently, I believe, galloping along the roadside. I don't recall at what distance, although, you know, what suggests itself to me is like, you know, about as close as I am to you or I am to the window.
Well, you know, here we have the first four cases in his top ten, in Greg's top ten. Aside from the Villaboas case, three of the four are of anomalous entities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which doesn't surprise me that Greg would pick those.
Which, with a suggestion of something that deposited them there. You know, but in contrast to things like the Betty and Barney Hill case or the Zamora sighting, nothing you could point to and say that's a physical craft.
Right. These were not classic close encounters of the third kind or even second kind, where the entities and objects are seen within the general frame of reference, the same same general frame of reference. So moving on to the rest here, we've got the Rex Heflin sighting and photos.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one that we talked about on one of our earlier shows.
Yes, it was the new analysis was published at UFO Iconoclast and gave me an early and still grudging respect for them, although they've published some howlers since then.
Oh, yeah. But they're as confrontational as one might think they are, so far they've been fairly nice to me, so we'll see how that lasts.
Next up is the Mothman sighting.
Woohoo! And here's another one that stands out as unlike classic. The Rex Heflin case, you know, as far as a physical evidence case, is radically different than anything else he's listed before in his top ten in terms of physical evidence. And of course, no entities in the Rex Heflin thing. But here we go again with another semi-anomalous entity.
Yeah, and this is something that I tend to feel is a bit far afield of ufology. It's one of my favorite cases, but I don't recall anything like a UFO. I suppose you could stretch it to say that, yes, the Mothman flew, and it hasn't been definitively identified.
I think he made reference, in the book, Mothman Prophecies, John Keel made brief references, at least, to supposed other sightings of lights in the sky.
Yeah.
But those weren't the things that he was focusing on, and as you say, as the movie implies, it's almost a demonological treatise, we're talking about the haunting of a town or an area by something and multiple somethings, and not just an object and entities, but a creature and, again, other weird archetypal themes like the Men in Black and doppelgangers and weird synchronicities, but especially the electromagnetic aspect He talks, I believe it's in that book, where he talks about finding a fear zone, where it was a clearly delineated zone where if he walked into it, he became incredibly fearful. When he walked through it or out of it or back backwards, it went away. That's most likely infrasound or some other vibratory phenomenon, whether it be electrical or
and
just
there's,
vibration. And of all his telephone weirdness and...
Mm-hmm. That zone of fear puts me in the mind of an article that was in Freudian Times many years ago on what they called the pan effect.
Panic.
Yeah, that basically there were areas that just sort of touched that cord, struck that cord or touched that nerve, and, nothing obviously dangerous, no obvious threats, just... anxiety and fear-inducing.
Yeah. Well, a number of electromagnetically minded parapsychologists and paranormal researchers have investigated those kinds of zones, and there's several that say absolutely that it's infrasound, at least in within houses. There can be infrasound areas, certainly, I'm sure Persinger of Laurentian University would probably say, oh, yeah, I can induce fear, that kind of sense electrically, by stimulating their brain. But then you're implying, like, the idea of geopathic zones, areas that might, affect somebody but just by being near them. So moving right along, number seven, we've got the Herbert Schirmer, Ashland, Nebraska, 1967 case. Patrolman encounters a landed craft-like object on a lonely stretch of highway and saw it take off. Okay, and of course he was hypnotized by Dr. Leo Sprinkle and related a type of onboard experience. We want you to believe in us, but not too much, is the quote from the hypnotic regression. Oh, number eight, man. Oh, I love it. I've got shells from Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Oh.
The Pascagoula, thanks to my good friend and author, John Carter. Pascagoula abduction, Mississippi, USA, 1973. There is an amazing analysis of the symbolisms, the hermeneutics of that case in my favorite book, whose title I love to say, Cyberbiological Studies of the Imaginal Component in the UFO Contact Experience. That book has this amazing, I think it's called Hermeneutic Encounters. No, wait. I forget. But it's all about hermeneutics, the Pascagoula, Mississippi abduction, and the symbolisms and signs in that, and it's just fantastic, and we'll have to talk about that more sometime.
Are
you familiar with that case?
Well, the Pascagoula case is interesting to me. It's been a long time since I've read anything about it. But I had the impression that the witness's credibility had been sort of brought into serious question some years subsequent. I don't know if the case was ever actually debunked. But
no, not to my knowledge at all. I wouldn't say that I'm all that familiar with the hardcore Randyites or anything, so I don't know. There could be somebody who's advanced an explanation or dug something up, but I've never seen anything credible or that I recall that debunked them. I mean, basically you have an older man and a younger man who were fishing on a pier and had an experience that scared the bejesus out of them.
Yeah, these three great golems.
With crab-like hands and long noses and no apparent eyes and weird protrusions for their nose and ears that were basically more or less the same.
Yeah, kind of long tapering cones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that they floated. They didn't walk. They floated and then floated them into the ship, which was... rather fish-like in various characteristics, including its aperture opening, the doorway opening, like a fish's mouth. There's all kinds of amazing symbolisms and hermeneutics in this case that I just I'm not prepared to go into, but it's fascinating.
All of a sudden now I want to sculpt one of the Pascagoula aliens.
They're really cool.
Oh, okay.
And moving again right along to number 9, Scary Night, Thousand Oaks, California, 1975, and uncovered by investigator Brian Veich. I don't think immediately I'm familiar with this one.
This sounds like a fairly new case.
Very creepy, and even if there is no proof as yet, the case has fireballs, scared animals, unearthly screams, and missing time. From the quotes from the witnesses, second of two that are given on this 14 Times article, I saw my dad and brother flinch down, and the scream was thunderous, by far the loudest we had heard, and the house was blocking me. My dad and brother came running up the driveway asking me if I'd seen the fireballs, which I hadn't. They said two blue fireballs came shooting over their heads and hit the hill, and immediately the thing screamed its shriek. This was the only time in my life I saw my dad scared. I think I've heard about this, but it's not something I'm that familiar with. Apparently involving an entity, fireballs, and a whole bunch of people being freaked. And number 10, hey, Texas made it. Woo!
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's kind of a sad case. The Cash Lindrum incident, Texas, 1980. This happened, I believe, I forget.
Outside of Houston.
Houston.
Between Houston and College Station, I want to say.
And this is a really, it's one of those cases where a lot of people immediately go, oh, it's government. You know, it's a secret aviation technology. And this is basically the Betty Cash and Vicki Landrum and their son, Cody or Kobe, are in the car on a highway. That there's not that much of the traffic, and they see come over the freeway upwards of 23 helicopters of various varieties, but mostly double-bladed Chinooks, surrounding and apparently corralling a diamond-shaped hovering object, spitting flames at various intervals towards the ground. And so powerful was the energy going on in this scenario that the Betty Cash and Vicki were experiencing the heat even at that distance.
Later displayed symptoms of radiation poisoning.
And ultimately, probably at least I think the grandmother, the older of the two, I think succumbed to this. And they actually sued the government. And I think the case was handled through Bergstrom Air Force Base at the time here in Austin before it was years before it was shut down. And basically the Air Force just denied any connection to it. And this is one of those cases where it's like, oh, okay, come on now. Where the hell could they have gotten that many helicopters? That alone should be enough of a paper trail, so to speak, to you know, find one's way back to where the origins of this op. You know, where was this operation headquartered out of? You know, where did, you know, and I think it was on Christmas Eve or around Christmas time.
There are all kinds of markers you could come up with, fuel use, individual aircraft, I assume they have something like an odometer or a clock that tracks maintenance hours and logs flight hours.
But, yeah, that case is always fascinating to me. Of course, I think maybe the first time I became aware of it was on, do you remember that TV show, That's Incredible? Fran Tarkenton and some other folks, a lady. They had them on, and I remember, you know, that was my earlier age spark, one of the sparks, I'm sure, that led me to be so obsessed with the subjects of UFOs. Thomas E. Bullard is one of the other guys on the list here, and this guy, he's a PhD in folklore from Indiana University, written on UFO abductions and pre-1947 aerial phenomena. And, of course, looks at the UFO subject from the perspective of folklore and anthropology. I had the pleasure of meeting him briefly when he was here in Austin for the 94-95 MUFON Symposium. I was the only person to recognize him, at least up until that point. Just sad, because he's just not that very – he's not very well known. But he's done a number of landmark works in the field. And he was one of the ones selected by 40 and Times to give his top 10, and perhaps we won't spend as much time on that since we're running out here, but number one.
Most of these are very well known.
The Father Gill case from 1959, this is a fascinating case where a missionary in New Guinea was... this is a really another anomalous case in that it's a very it lasted a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
I believe upwards of hours, during which it was like they're having a dinner party, and he and the locals and his guests at the dinner party repeatedly came out onto the patio and waved and seemingly interacted with the entities on this strange platform, this hovering platform that was presumed... It was just like, oh, it's got to be some, you know, military thing, mm-hmm. and eventually we'll hear about it. And so, you know, and obviously they're waving back, so, you know, they're not shooting or they're not attacking, but they're not landing either. Number two, Betty and Barney Hill, 1961. This one is as really, really famous, and as is the next one, the Exeter, New Hampshire, 1965 case. That was basically the case of, I believe, more of a cylindrical, cigar-shaped object with multiple red lights being seen up and down a roadway, terrorizing people. Disturbed livestock, calm down, only when the object departed. Moving to number four, we've got in the Thomas Bullard's list of top UFO cases, the January 2000 Southern Illinois police chase case. This has got to be that... We've talked about this before, the black triangle. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Where the lights were headed, an officer saw what he described as a triangular black dark object with lights at each corner at Shiloh and Millstatt. Venus.
Yeah, I remember. This is, it's interesting because I remember talking about this on an old show, and the thing that had struck me about the presentation of it, it was a half an hour travel channel or learning channel mm-hmm. show, I believe. And I had the impression that the sightings, four distinct cases reported, the sightings took place over the span of about 5 hours. And here he says... the series of sightings lasted about half an hour. Something worth checking. Number five is...
RoboZero Marvel?
RoboZero Marvel.
I love it. Okay, apparently this goes outside of the bounds of what 40 Times was calling for. They wanted top 10 cases from between 1947 and 2007, and this is a case 1663, published in St. Petersburg Archaeographic Society Archives for 1842. The report actually exists and went on record long before ideas of USOs could influence the account. You know, I don't know which case this is. There's so many like this, you know, with the famous woodcuts that show swords and shields in the sky to, you know, cylinders ejecting spheres that then fly around in the classic cloud cigar configuration. And, ho, look.
Mm-hmm.
There's only five in this.
Yeah.
That's the last one. Okay, that's... Well, it is just about 8 o'clock anyway. You can find out about the rest of this panel of ufologists from Bill Chalker, Stan Friedman, Nick Pope, and Jenny Randles. You can find that at 40andtimes.com. And, we didn't get around to one of the things I wanted to mention, but I'll do it really quick. You know, with all the fanfare about the Roswell Festival, the 60th anniversary, interestingly enough, an article came out from Newburyport, and I don't even know where that is, Newburyport. It sounds
like Massachusetts.
Their daily news online, that's newburyportnews.com, has run an article headlined, "Did Suspected UFO Cover-Up Have Ties to Port?" by Nick Pinto.
Oh, boy.
And basically, it's just like, they're, it's like, oh, there's this guy that's known locally, you know, and hey, it's the anniversary, and hey, there's a connection. And I mention this because just a little interesting coincidence here, something to consider. A central figure in the purported government suppression of proof of alien life was Gordon Gray, a former Secretary of the Army whose curriculum vitae also included secret government psychological warfare programs, top secret security consultations with the Oval Office, and, oddly enough, the preservation of historic downtown Newburyport. So it's a little, you know, oh, you know, it's a little kind of a fluff piece in some ways, but the fact that they mentioned that he was connected to psychological warfare and they're suggesting that he was part of the cover-up, I just found that a nice little coincidence since, as I in the aforementioned UFO updates list about 10 years ago, I was mentioning the fact that Roswell could have been early psychological warfare, that perhaps even at, in 1947 they had... the Army had considered the idea of using UFOs as cover stories and or psychological warfare elements in certain stratagems and covert ops. Back in, this is in, October of 98. And interestingly, I was pointing to Jacques Vallée, who talked about the influence among early UFO groups by people who had direct ties to psychological warfare. And what did I say? Does anyone know whether or not the principals involved in Roswell had backgrounds in psychological warfare? And here we are, almost 10 years later. And
wondering.
Somebody offhand mentions that, oh, yeah, this guy who's considered to have been part of the government suppression of that proves nothing. Absolutely nothing. All right, folks.
I think it's a spacecraft and shoot for myself. Well, dadgabbit, we can say nothing at all about
archaeology.
What would you call it? Crypto-archaeology?
Forbidden archaeology.
Forbidden archaeology.
Suppressed archaeology.
Or, you know, pseudo-archaeology, as some archaeologists call it.
Well, we'll try to take that up next time on Precognitive Distance. He has a couple of books that I got signed from my pal Paul Devereaux, who's an expert in megalithic sites and such.
We'll be talking a little bit about Barry Feld and William Corliss, Science Frontiers Online, and maybe say something about Eric Von Däniken. We'll get some special friends. Join us next time when we take the little Scoutmaster out for a trip in the neighborhood.
Right,
or
thanks.
Maybe just the hood.
All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. This is Snodge Lewis.
And Greg, you are signing off
for
Precognitive Dissonance.